Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hey there, it's Chris Bentley, host of Here and Now Anytime. Let me ask you a quick favor. It's easy, but important to me and everyone who works on this show. If you like that we're here every afternoon, bringing you fresh perspectives and insightful conversations on the big stories of the day, take 5 seconds and follow Here and Now Anytime, wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. And if you want to make us really happy and help other people find this show, leave us a good review. It really helps. And thanks. Now here's the show.
Scammers are using gift cards in a variety of ways, and we have to view them as more than just a nice impulse buy or gift to give somebody. They are a vehicle for money laundering and for fraud now.
Gift card? More like grift card. It's Wednesday, April 17th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, three great stories. In about 15 minutes, we'll hear how a network of gift card scammers has stolen billions of dollars from unsuspecting shoppers at big box stores, and what federal law enforcement is doing about it. Also, Iran's attack on Israel is part of a new era of drone warfare, says one analyst.
We're going to see air defense becoming a very important piece of the puzzle to confront these drone threats, but we're also going to see the real importance of intelligence in terms of trying to hit these drones and missiles before they even take off.
But first, in Chattanooga, Tennessee today, workers at a Volkswagen plant are casting their ballots over whether they want to join the United Auto Workers Union. The vote is expected to last 3 days and could have major implications for union organizing in the South. This comes after the UAW struck historic contracts with the big three automakers in Detroit last year. Michael Martinez has been covering the union for Automotive News. Here's his conversation with Scott Tong.
You spoke to some workers at this plant where they assembled the VW Atlas SUV and the ID.4 electric vehicle. What did they tell you about this effort to unionize?
Well, a lot of them told me that it's different than before. If you remember, there were two votes at that same plant, one in 2019, one in 2014, union supporters lost those votes. And the workers say this is different. There's more enthusiasm behind this effort, and they're really trying to continue the momentum of the UAW with its wins here in Detroit last fall.
And for workers who, you know, say they're inclined to vote in favor of joining the union, did they tell you, you know, why, what it could mean for their wages, for their lives?
It really comes down to one word, and I'd say that's stability. They all admit that they have pretty good jobs at VW. The company pays pretty well compared to the rest of the opportunities in the area. But what they saw in Detroit was union workers arguing for and winning better wages, better benefits, better bonuses than what they have. One quick example, profit sharing for GM and Stellantis. That pays out, this year paid out between $10,000 and $14,000 to workers. So their eyes got big when they saw those contracts in Detroit, and they want to get some of those same things.
And for the UAW, for the union, what are the stakes here beyond this one particular plan? Could it set a precedent in the South?
This vote is absolutely critical. The union's trying to organize over a dozen automakers. They really want to help boost their membership. It's been falling for years. It's now at the lowest level since the Great Recession. And a victory here, the union officials believe, and union supporters in Tennessee believe, it could really have a domino-like effect. It could get the process rolling, put more pressure on other companies that are trying to avoid unionization, and really help the cause.
And Michael, I understand we won't know the results until Friday night earliest. Any early indications how this may go?
Well, I think you've seen a number of differences between the past campaigns that indicates there's more enthusiasm on the ground, that maybe some of the folks that have been undecided or voted no in the past may be coming around. You've seen the union switch strategies too. Before, it was sort of a top-down officials from Detroit telling them how to run things. This time it's more grassroots. They've left it up to the workers to decide what the best strategy is and to learn from their own past mistakes and the past failed drives. So I think that could play a role here. So really it's going to come down to how the workers feel and the information that they're getting from both sides and what they think is best for them.
Michael, what is management saying, VW management?
Well, VW is remaining neutral, which is significant in and of itself because in 2019, during the last vote, they were more openly hostile and more anti-union in their sentiment. But beyond VW, the political establishment has really been pushing back lately.
We've also seen Republican governors in the South pushing back directly. They argue that the cost of business in their states is low, in part because wages are lower than other parts of the country. And as the argument goes, if you mess with this picture, the big employers are not going to move to the South anymore. How much traction does that argument have?
I think there's some real worry there. The fear is, and what the opposition has argued, is that if you unionize, costs will go up. We may not get as much investment here, and workers could lose their jobs.
All right, we've been talking to Michael Martinez. He covers Ford and the United Auto Workers for Automotive News. Michael, thank you.
Thanks so much.
They built my car at that Chattanooga plant, by the way. Not going to weigh in on the union drive, but it's a good car. Coming up next, drones are relatively cheap and, of course, can be deadly. No wonder some are calling them a shortcut to a poor man's Air Force. After the break, Scott speaks with one military analyst about the new era of drone warfare. Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why accessibility is central to Betterment's mission.
The real innovation for Betterment was taking a set of tools that were used by the ultra wealthy and making them accessible to the average investor. And that includes tax strategies, that includes dollar cost averaging. These are all sort of tricks of the trade.
Learn more about automated investing technology at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
In Israel over the weekend, drone warfare played a central role in Iran's overnight strike on Israel. And for its part, Israel has been flying combat drones supplemented with artificial intelligence in its war in Gaza. So, have we entered a new age of drone warfare? And what are the implications of these cheap, long-distance, unmanned flying weapons? With us now is Caitlin Lee. She's an expert on drones and directs the National Security Research Division at the RAND Corporation think tank. Caitlin, hello.
Hi, Scott. How are you?
Well, drones for war have been around. You've told us that the U.S., for instance, used them in its war on terror. But this attack from Iranian drones Saturday night, to you, is this a new chapter in drone warfare?
I do think it's one of the opening salvos in what likely could be us entering sort of a new drone and missile age. Really, drones, unmanned aircraft, they've kind of come and gone in terms of U.S. military use. And then, of course, after 9/11, we saw their use explode. And then we saw another sort of, I think, distinct drone age as middle powers, places like Ukraine, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Georgia, these kinds of places start to get access to drones because they are lower cost. And you start to see them in sort of state-on-state conflict. And now with Iran launching this latest attack on Israel, I think you're starting to see another sort of era of the drone revolution, which is starting to use drones at much greater ranges and in combination with missiles. I do think this marked a new era where you're starting to see countries like Iran sort of engage in this global network of, you know, exporting these drones and drone parts. For example, we know Iran is working with Russia to export those drones, but then also using these drones and missiles to sort of strike targets at range to protect their interests. And in many ways, sort of offset sort of some inferiority in their conventional military forces.
Yeah. The thing is, Caitlin, you know, Israel and its allies over the weekend, its allies, Jordan, the U.S., the U.K., shot down most of these Iranian drones. Does that suggest a weakness in this drone technology?
I think it reflects a continuing sort of measure-countermeasure fight that we've watched evolve in Ukraine and will continue to evolve. For every new drone that's invented that has, you know, more hardening against electronic warfare, for example, you'll see better air defense systems emerge to counter those drones. And that will be an ongoing dynamic that we will continue to see play out. But I think what's sort of new and different here is what Iran's especially been doing since the beginning of the year. Like, first of all, in the past, they've used proxies to launch drone attacks against U.S. interests and allies. This was a direct drone attack. It was also the largest drone attack a country has carried out against another country that we've ever seen. And so those are some really important firsts. And then pile onto that the fact that just earlier this year, some Iranian proxies actually killed U.S. military forces in Jordan for the first time. Yes. That was the first time a drone strike killed U.S. forces. So I do think we're sort of entering this new period where there are going to be these huge questions about, like, how effective is air defense? And I think what you saw with the attack on Israel was a combination of using sort of these kinetic layered missile defenses in combination with really good intelligence that allowed us, the U.S., working with Israel to get left of launch and actually hit some of these drones and ballistic missile launch sites before they even took off. And so I think it's a combination of, yes, we're going to see air defense becoming a very important piece of the puzzle to confront these drone threats, but we're also going to see the real importance of intelligence in terms of trying to hit these drones and missiles before they even take off.
I guess the thing is, if a missile to shoot down a drone costs, say, $1 million, and the drone itself is 1/20th the cost, you know, 50 grand or something, at a certain point, there's a huge economic advantage, as it were, to the drones.
Absolutely. And that's why I think it's so important to try to think about ways to avoid getting into a situation where you're going bullet for bullet, as it were, because those cost exchange ratios do not favor the air defense system. That said, a huge caveat here, and it depends on what you're trying to protect. In this case, it was defending, you know, places like Tel Aviv. It was defending the civilian population. So even if it cost $1 million to shoot one missile, that's well worth it because they've protected their population.
Caitlin, you and others have called this a poor man's air force, right? These drones cost a fraction, as we said, of a missile. Iran has built this drone industry for years, despite all these years of international sanctions. They can fly 1,200 miles or so. Is the reality that this is democratizing warfare in a way?
Yes, absolutely. This is what we're seeing. Places like Iran are, yes, they're going to go towards things like missiles and drones to offset those conventional military disadvantages. And I think you're also going to see that happen with non-state actors. Drones are widely accessible to anyone with access to the internet, essentially. And as we've seen in Ukraine, they can be pretty easily tricked out with different sensors or just rigged with mortars. And there's sort of a strange brew and mixing of this off-the-shelf technology with more sophisticated systems. So what you start to see is these low-cost weapon systems that are highly effective, these sort of Goldilocks weapon systems. I would put the Iran Shahed in that category.
Briefly, I want to ask you about drones and artificial intelligence more broadly in Israel's war in Gaza. We have reports of drones equipped with AI working in tandem with an AI tool that cross-references data that has picked more than 30,000 presumed Hamas targets. Is this use of technology kind of a next level of drone warfare?
I definitely think it's the next level. And actually, Israel has really been at the forefront of this. And I think what's new here is now Israel reportedly has a system, Lavender, where they can actually target humans. And so the drone has sort of this database of human targets, and it matches that up with what it sees on the ground. And so what's new here is that now this AI-driven autonomy is being used not just to hit stationary or inanimate objects, but now human beings. And I think that's definitely next level. And that's where, you know, there's some legitimate concerns about, well, how do you verify those targets and how do you keep that AI in check? This is definitely a new frontier.
Yeah. Caitlin Lee is a director at the National Security Research Division at the RAND Corporation think tank. Caitlin, thank you once again.
Thanks, Scott.
Coming up, gift cards. They're great for shoppers who don't know what to get for someone. And retailers like them because the recipient usually spends more than their card balance at the store. But there's one group that's really getting the most out of gift cards. Scammers. A network of thieves with ties to organized crime in China has stolen billions of dollars through gift card scams. And now federal law enforcement agents are sounding the alarm. Robin Young has the story when we return.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Get your quote at progressive.com and see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Arctic Wolf. Their researchers have released the Arctic Wolf Lab's 2024 threat report. Why will 2024 be a volatile year for cybersecurity? Learn more and get your copy now at arcticwolf.com/NPR.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you been a victim of card draining? That's what it's called when thieves drain the gift cards that you may have bought to give someone else. They take all the money. It goes like this. Criminals steal gift cards from a store display. They copy the numbers, slap on a new barcode, put the cards back on a rack, and an unwitting customer loads their own money onto this tampered card that the criminal then steals. Federal agents say the scheme is coordinated. It's tied to Chinese organized crime, and it's huge. Craig Silverman has been reporting on this for ProPublica. He's here now with more. Craig, how huge? How big is this?
Well, we know from court documents that, for example, Target itself had told local police at one point that it's seen $300 million in losses to customers. So that's just one company, and that could have just been in the last year or so. Yeah. So Department of Homeland Security have said this could certainly go into the billions of dollars in losses, because one factor with this is gift cards are often gifts. And when you receive a gift card from someone and there's no money on it, you probably feel a little bit bashful about going back to them saying, hey, there's no money here. And so the amount of losses is hard to project because so much of it goes unreported.
Right. It was a gift, and you think maybe the gifter forgot to put money on it or something, but it's actually a grifter who took the money off it. And you and your colleague Peter Elkind reported that this is so big that the Department of Homeland Security has launched a task force. They've had meetings. How does this work? We know these gift cards hang on those little hooks on store kiosks. That's also why the project is called Project Red Hook, because the perpetrators are tied to China, a pejorative there for many, but the cards are hung on hooks. So pick up there. How do they know this is tied to Chinese rings?
Well, one of the things that we've seen in our reporting is that pretty much everyone we have seen arrested doing this activity, you know, going into stores, taking the good cards off, putting the tampered ones back on, they're either Chinese nationals or Chinese Americans. And this is a trend that we have seen actually going back to other reporting we've done on other types of gift card scams as well, that there does seem to be organized elements with ties back to China and to organized crime there. And this has been going on now for at least a year where it's been really, really bad, but probably predates that. They just seem to have found this loophole, this way to extract money through card draining, and then they turned it into a very organized national operation involving what DHS estimated to us could be, you know, 1,000 people or more running around, driving around the country, doing this kind of tampering and card replacing.
Because this is also funding what these criminal organizations are doing. You've reported on this, how Chinese organized crime is involved in illegal marijuana industry, the laundering of cocaine, heroin, fentanyl products. This money is being turned back into really troubling criminal activity.
Yeah, the operations that are doing card draining are involved in, you know, illegal drug trafficking. They're involved in some cases in human trafficking. They are massively involved in money laundering for their own drug proceeds and for the drug proceeds of other narco traffickers. So this gift card operation isn't just a separate thing. It is part of this massive kind of criminal enterprise. Yeah. And one of the reasons that card draining is become popular for them is it is an easier way to kind of get money back to China. So, you know, let's say you owe $1 million to an organization back in China because of the fentanyl that, you know, you brought in and sold in the United States. If you can get $1 million worth of money drained from cards in the United States and then turn that into, for example, Apple products that you would buy with the stolen funds from gift cards, then you get the Apple products, you ship those back to China, and that pays off your debt. So it is very much integrated into the money laundering and movement of money through these larger criminal organizations.
Yeah. And by the way, just a quick question, because I'm sure consumers are sitting up. How does it work? I mean, somebody goes in a store and then they bring it back somewhere and tamper with it. But won't you see that? If you go, I always look at a gift card to see if the paper is torn or something.
Yeah, and that is a really good practice, that the reality is we all need to adopt that now. Card draining is not completely new. This has been going on for a good decade or so. But what is new is the scale of the operation of targeting it. So it is really essential now that people realize they have to take on a little more responsibility around gift cards. So, you know, investigating the ones you see on the racks, turning them around. Do they look tampered with? You know, are the barcodes askew? Is there tearing on the packaging? That kind of thing. Really, really important. And also, you know, if you are buying them, you should be keeping the receipt. If you give them to people, give them the receipt. And if there's an opportunity to register that gift card to yourself, for example, Apple gift cards, you associate them with your Apple ID, you should do that as soon as possible, because if something does happen, you know, that's a lot better. And I do think people need to just realize that gift cards now are a massive vector for fraud and scams. Not only is there the card draining element where you may give or receive a card with no money on it, a lot of people who are getting scammed with, you know, romance scams or being told they owe money to the government, they're being told to go and buy gift cards, because a gift card, really, at the end of the day, it's just the code and the PIN. And whoever gets that code and that PIN controls the money on it. And so scammers are using gift cards in a variety of ways. And we have to view them as more than just a nice impulse buy or gift to give somebody. They are a vehicle for money laundering and for fraud now.
And ProPublica writes that Walmart and some other retailers are facilitating this. How so?
We looked specifically at Walmart because, one, it is, you know, very much ubiquitous in the country. But Walmart has also, over, you know, about two decades, offered a wide variety of financial services. So they have money transfers at Walmart. They have not just Walmart gift cards, but all kinds of gift cards at Walmart. And what we had seen is that as Walmart expanded its financial offerings, it was very slow or ineffective at implementing oversight and protections to keep people from, you know, being scammed and then going to Walmart at the direction of the scammer and sending that money transfer out. There was a lot of issues with the money transfer business for a long time. And we also found that Walmart back in 2018 had promised two state attorney generals in New York and Pennsylvania that they would stop allowing people to, for example, use a gift card to buy another gift card, which is a common laundering procedure, And it failed to do that for almost 4 years. And we found a completely separate scheme with a link to China where tens of millions of dollars was laundered through Walmart stores using Walmart gift cards. And so, you know, they say that they take fraud very seriously and have implemented a lot of protections, but we found a lot of times where they didn't do what they said they would do and, you know, really failed to apply the correct oversight.
There's one line in your writing that really jumps out, and it's from a Homeland Security investigator who tells you that a single runner and these are the people who, you know, get the cards. Driving from store to store can swipe or return thousands of tampered cards in a very short time. What they do is they just fly into the city, they get a rental car, and they just hit every big box location they can. Thousands. That's astonishing.
It's an almost industrial operation because what's happening is, you know, the runner is responsible for one, taking gift cards off, obviously, and then in some cases they tamper or somebody else tampers. But two, they're also responsible for putting gift cards back on. And so what we've seen in court documents is that there are runners who they start their day, they might drive to a UPS location and pick up boxes full of thousands and thousands of cards that have been shipped to that location for them to pick up. And so, you know, they're sort of smart in the sense that they don't necessarily take the cards out of one store and then go back to that same store. They have an operation that the cards are taken, collected, aggregated, and then shipped across the country to be picked up by another runner to use those. And so people who've been arrested have, in some cases, have had more than 5,000 cards in their possession. And that's just for their work for, you know, the next few days or the next week or two. It's really a remarkably large operation.
Some of them, some of these runners told police they were hired, you know, through online postings. One of them at a Florida Target, who was noticed by employees, said he was paid 30 cents a card. For the ones that he put back. It's just amazing. How have, if they have, the Chinese authorities responded?
So that's one of the things that we hear from law enforcement, which is that they get basically no cooperation from China. And so that's one of the reasons why it's very difficult for federal investigators to get anywhere other than just the kind of low-level runners on this. At the end of the day, you know, they're communicating with people via WeChat, which is a Chinese social media application. The bank transfers and the money transfers, certainly, you know, they go back to China in many cases. And that's just a dead end. They get basically no cooperation there. And so the concern is that, you know, they can keep arresting runners. They can try to disrupt this as much as possible. But the idea that they could do something that attacks it systematically, that seems very unlikely.
Well, buyer beware. ProPublica reporter Craig Silverman will link you to his report with colleague Peter Elkind on gift card fraud at herenow.org. Craig, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That's our show. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Sam Rapelson, Shirley Jihad, and me, Chris Bentley. Our editors are Todd Munt, Ahmad Daman, Peter O'Dowd, Micaela Rodriguez, Michael Scotto, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. Follow us in your podcast app of choice right now if you haven't already, so you don't miss any of our new episodes. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Homes.com. Homes.com knows having the right agent can make or break your home search. That's why they provide home shoppers with an agent directory that gives you a detailed look at each agent's experience, like the number of closed sales in a specific neighborhood, average price range, and more. It lets you easily connect with all the agents in the area you're searching, so you can find the right agent with the right experience and ultimately the right home for you. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Anthropic. Their Claude 3 model family is enterprise-ready AI. Haiku is fast and cost-effective. Sonnet perfectly balances skill with speed. And Opus sets new intelligence industry benchmarks. Visit anthropic.com/Claude.
On NPR's Throughline,
we cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt. because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.